Welcome to today's reading of the San Angelo Standard Times, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
Hello, this is Michael. I'm going to be reading the San Angelo Standard Times for the week of Sunday, February 28th, 2021. I'm reading on Thursday, March 4th. We'll begin with the most recent articles. COVID-19 update. Tom Green County as of March 3rd from the city of San Angelo. 16,379 positive cases reported. 15 new positive tests. Deaths, 301, 191 from Tom Green County and 107 from other counties. 17 currently hospitalized. 533 active cases. It will be about personal choice. San Angelo mayor and officials react to end of mask order by John Tufts, published March 3rd. Reactions to Texas Governor Greg Abbott's recent decision to end a statewide mask mandate and open Texas 100% a year after COVID-19 spread across the state have received mixed reactions from the public, which includes San Angelo officials. On Tuesday, March 2nd, 2021, Abbott issued a new executive order, which will take effect March 10th and rescind most of his earlier orders, including restrictions on business occupancy and statewide mask order from July. Texas is in a far better position now than when I issued my last executive order back in October, Abbott said Tuesday, referring to his order allowing bars to reopen under certain circumstances. Cases spiked after he eased business restrictions in the fall. While health experts around the state and nation have warned against easing mask mandates, several elected officials approve Abbott's reopening of Texas. San Angelo Mayor Brenda Gunter is one of them. Gunter, it will be about personal choice. I believe it was the correct decision, Gunter stated in a Wednesday email to the Standard Times. San Angelo citizens have been committed to stopping the spread. As a city, our numbers have continued to decrease, and at the same time, the number of vaccines we have given has exceeded 30,000. As of Tuesday, Tom Green County has administered more than 29,400 doses of the COVID-19 vaccine, as cases continue to rise in the state, according to data from the Texas Department of State Health Services. The city of San Angelo reported 11 new positive cases of COVID-19 on Tuesday. There were 19 people hospitalized and 554 active cases of the virus, according to a release from the city. Chris Van Dusen, a spokesman for the Texas Department of State Health Services, said Monday it's not yet clear how last month's winter storm, which left thousands sheltering in warming centers and others' homes, would impact COVID-19 cases. Regardless, we're still seeing too many new cases and people in the hospital, and any rebound from now would be a problem, Van Dusen told the American Statesman. We're making good progress in getting people vaccinated and still need people to take precautions as that continues. Gunter applauded the efforts of residents to limit the spread of the virus and said the matter of wearing a mask in public will come down to a personal decision. We, as a city, have consistently followed Abbott's executive orders, Gunter stated. Citizens will still have a choice to wear a mask or not wear a mask. Those who still want the protection may make that personal choice to wear a mask. Businesses may still choose if they wish to recommend wearing a mask. It will be about personal choice, she stated. Floyd says our citizens are fully aware of the risk. Tom Green County Judge Steve Floyd also welcomed Abbott's decision to end mask mandates and reopen the state, but also addressed that measures were still in place in cases in the area if cases in the area begin to spike again. Abbott's new order will allow all businesses to expand their occupancy rates to 100%. However, county officials may use COVID mitigation strategies if COVID-19 hospitalizations rise above 15% of an area's total bed capacity for 7 straight days, Abbott said Tuesday. Most of the COVID-19 restrictions were to protect hospital capacity, Floyd stated in an email. As a county judge, I still have some authority to take some measures if our hospital capacity reaches 15% COVID patients. Floyd stated Tom Green County's trauma service area, Trauma Region K, has been the lowest out of 22 such areas in Texas for nearly a month. State hospital data, last updated March 2nd, showed Trauma Region K with a hospitalization rate of 2.39%. Trauma service areas near Tom Green County had higher hospitalization rates. While not going into specifics, Floyd stated he and Gunter began efforts to ease some restrictions a week ago. Actions, he stated, were in support of the city's signature event, the San Angelo Stock Show and Rodeo. Although I was aware that Governor Abbott was considering modifying his orders, I was surprised by the complete removal of the restrictions, Floyd stated. Tom Green County residents were responsible for our local success in combating COVID, and I'm pleased they can enjoy the fruits of their efforts. Our citizens are fully aware of the risk and protective measures, and we trust they will make the best decisions in their best interest, he stated. Vretis says, I'll be wearing a mask for the next year or two at least. One person who remains skeptical of ending the mask mandate is Tom Green County Local Health Authority, Dr. James Vretis, who has consistently urged residents to wear masks. During an interview Wednesday, Vretis said Abbott's decision to reopen Texas made sense from an economic standpoint, but not from a medical one. I don't know of any medical reasons why we should end the mask mandate at this time, Vretis said. I understand our numbers are low, but we still have COVID in our community. We have the advent of COVID variants. There's one in New York and one in California that appear to be more transmissible than the first string. Vretis isn't alone in his reluctance for elected officials to suspend wearing masks. CDC Director Dr. Rochelle Walensky recently said during a White House briefing she was worried states removing public health measures would lead to a return of COVID-19 spiking in communities. Please hear me clearly. At this level of cases, with variant spreading, we stand to completely lose the hard-earned ground we have gained, Walensky said. Vretis said while he personally doesn't like wearing masks, he plans to keep wearing one for a while. I'll be wearing masks the next year or two at least, Vretis said. If people have the opportunity to make the right decision, make the right decision in wearing your mask. Shannon Medical Center. Masks still required. In a news release issued Wednesday on social media, a spokesperson with Shannon Medical Center said masks would still be required for both visitors and staff at the hospital. Shannon is regulated by the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid, CMS, and must abide by their guidelines. CMS is still requiring all patients, visitors, and staff to wear masks while in our facilities, a news release stated. Patients and visitors will still be required to complete a COVID-19 screening at all hospital entrances, according to the release. The health and well-being of our providers, staff, and patients remains our top priority. We continue to take numerous measures to provide a safe environment for all of our patients, the release stated. San Angelo ISD, assessing the situation. Officials with the San Angelo Independent School District said they were assessing the situation on what steps the district would take in the wake of Abbott's decision. Based on Governor Abbott's executive order that takes effect March 10, 2021, San Angelo ISD is assessing the situation and awaiting clarification from our local health officials, Centers for Disease Control, CDC, and the Texas Education Agency, TEA, with consideration of the best interests of our students, staff, and community, a statement read on its official website. Officials said they would continue with the district's current safety protocols in schools until further notice. Crime Stoppers of San Angelo celebrates 40th anniversary by Rosanna Frayer, published March 3rd. Crime Stoppers of San Angelo celebrated 40 years of serving the community on March 1st. Crime Stoppers of San Angelo was established in 1981 to partner with local law enforcement to provide important information from the public while giving them the ability to do it anonymously. We have seen our organization receive a fluctuating number of tips over time, leading to many arrests, said Trevor Bohannon, vice president of Crime Stoppers local board of directors. Looking forward, we would like to get even more involved in the community and are seeking partnerships with local companies and individuals that may be unable to volunteer but are willing to donate to our programs. As a nonprofit organization, Crime Stoppers of San Angelo relies on donations to pay out rewards and help gather information for local law enforcement agencies. Crime Stoppers was first formed in 1976 by a police detective in Albuquerque, New Mexico, who was concerned about the increasing number of unsolved crimes. The detective knew that information from the public would be helpful in solving cases, but without guaranteed anonymity, it was difficult to get that information, Bohannon said. Members in that community came together to form the first Crime Stoppers and shared this idea with other communities. Bohannon said when he previously saw Crime Stoppers in the community, he always thought it was part of the police department. When I learned that it is a separate nonprofit that is volunteer-ran, I sought out an opportunity to help in any way I can, he said. Crime Stoppers is a very important part of our community since it brings information, otherwise unknown, to the proper authorities. People can donate online at sanangelocrimestoppers.com or by mail to San Angelo Crime Stoppers, P.O. Box 5020, San Angelo, Texas 76902. It smells like a dead animal. San Angelo water complaints reveal what Paul Ann experienced, by John Tufts, published March 3rd. On a bright but breezy Monday morning, February 8th, 2021, Elena Velez-Reyes received a phone call from a concerned resident living in San Angelo's Paul Ann neighborhood. The caller complained something was wrong with their water. Velez-Reyes, who serves as laboratory manager for San Angelo's water quality division, logged the complaint with the following notation. Customer stated water smelled like chemicals. It wasn't the only complaint Velez-Reyes and other city officials would receive during the next 24 hours concerning San Angelo's rapidly deteriorating water quality. There would be more complaints, dozens more. City staff arrived at the resident's address in the 2800 block of Joshua Street early that same Monday, the last day of warm 80-degree weather before a record-setting and deadly winter blizzard swept across Texas. Much like the blizzard itself, a chemical tempest was churning in San Angelo's water pipes, and the storm was about to hit. Documents stated crews collected water samples from the Joshua Street home, in which they noted a mothball-like odor. Velez-Reyes finished her 10 a.m. report, citing the customer was advised to not use water to consume as of yet. Then another call, complaining about the water in Paul Ann, alerted the officials to Johnny Lane, and then to Watson Street, and then to Rick's Court, and Sun Lake Drive, McGill Boulevard, Odell Street, Diamond Drive, and the calls didn't stop. City crews collected water samples in the area, which were shipped overnight to an independent laboratory to determine the cause of the odor. 3 days later, the city identified the contaminants as benzene, acetone, and naphthalene. At 4:11 p.m., Monday, February 8, the customer service manager for San Angelo's water department, Petra Trevino, sent an urgent email to Allison Strube, Tim Combest, and Andy Vasilio in the Water Utilities Department, stating her staff had fielded more than 20 calls about the smell and quality of water in the Paul Ann area. Trevino would later send two more emails in short succession, adding more Paul Ann addresses to a growing list of complaints. At 4:19 p.m., the City of San Angelo issued a Do Not Use Water advisory, warning residents citywide to not use water for anything other than flushing toilets and watering lawns. The advisory triggered school closures, event cancellations, and led to businesses, which were still reeling from lost revenue due to COVID-19, once again closing their doors. Local grocery stores brought in truckloads of water that flew off shelves Tuesday morning as residents stockpiled, uncertain of how long the water ban would last or what prompted the city to take such drastic measures. Prior to issuing that advisory, phone logs and complaint records from the Water Utilities Department, as well as emails from public officials, reveal what some Paulan residents experienced leading up to San Angelo's worst infrastructure crisis in recent memory. These records were obtained by the Standard Times on Monday, March 1st, after filing Freedom of Information Act requests to the City of San Angelo and to the Texas Commission on Environmental Quality on February 9th, one day after the city issued its advisory. The complaints. A bad odor on Odell Street. Complaint records obtained by the Standard Times suggest chemical contaminants in San Angelo's water appeared before Monday, February 8th. Phone logs from the Water Department, beginning in February, record Paulan customers complaining of water odor on McGill Boulevard that Sunday. At 12:35 p.m. Monday, staff with the Water Quality Division arrived at an address in the 3000 block of Odell Street after a resident complained their water had a bad odor. She called before and staff went and checked water, but no odor was detected. Customer stated odor got worse over the weekend, record state. City staff who arrived Monday and collected samples at the Odell residence said they detected a strong odor. Record state they advised the resident not to use water from the faucet until investigators could run more tests, which they would follow up with a phone call. Velez Reyes called the resident at 7:25 p.m., record state. Another resident at a second address in the 3000 block of Odell Street said their water smelled like burnt plastic for at least a week, according to a complaint filed at 2:48 p.m., Monday, February 8th. Staff told the resident they were currently investigating the issue and that the city had received several complaints already. Records state staff also advised the resident not to use their water and to check the city's website and social media platforms for more information throughout the evening. A complaint. The water smells metallic on Voigt Boulevard. At 4 p.m. February 8th, less than 20 minutes before officials issued the citywide Do Not Use advisory, a resident in the 3300 block of Voigt Boulevard said their water smelled metallic and like iodine or betadine. City staff said they were aware of several complaints in the area and also advised the resident not to use their water and recommend they check the city's official website later for updates. Complaint records list a Paulan resident living in the 1300 block of Gregory Drive who told officials their water smelled like a dead animal. Paulan resident, I thought I was having a panic attack. Chrisanda Holden has lived in the Paulan neighborhood for 6 months. Prior to February 8th, her family would use tap water to bathe, brush their teeth, and wash dishes. All normal things residents expect city water can be relied on for. Holden said she's been forced to radically alter her routine. On Sunday, February 8th, Holden said she and her husband first detected an odor coming out of the faucet. There was a slight odor Sunday, but we didn't think it was anything to be alarmed about, Holden said. On Monday, the odor in Holden's home became worse, and she likened it to being inside a machine shop. She said her family almost immediately began to feel sick. We used city water for my husband's coffee. He later got stomach issues, Holden said. My husband, me, and my child were all lethargic Monday morning. Holden said her 2-year-old child, who took a bath earlier that Sunday, woke up the next morning with projectile vomiting. She worries her family may have been exposed to dangerous levels of naphthalene and benzene. The U.S. Department of Human and Health Services lists naphthalene as reasonably anticipated to be a human carcinogen, citing a study that found the compound causes cancer in lab rats. In particular, it may be associated with a higher risk of colorectal and laryngeal cancers. Inhaling naphthalene can cause nausea, dizziness, and vomiting. In some cases, exposure to large amounts can cause anemia. Ingesting naphthalene could cause kidney damage. Benzene is a known human carcinogen. It has been linked to an increased risk of lymphatic and hematopoietic cancers, acute myelogenous leukemia, and chronic lymphomic leukemia. Similar to naphthalene, inhaling moderate to high amounts of acetone for a short amount of time can cause nose, throat, lungs, and eye irritation. Holden, 35, said she experienced both brain fog and heart palpitations to the point where she thought she was having a panic attack. Her family has used bottled water to wash dishes and brush their teeth since mid-February. "We got progressively sicker," Holden said. "It wasn't until Thursday, February 11th, when we started to feel normal again. It's completely affected our life. I don't even cook with city water," she said. "It's hard, you know. It's hard when you're yelling at a two-year-old not to turn on the sink when his whole life he's turned the sink on, and you have to swat at his hand because you don't know what's in that cup of water." On March 2nd, Holden attended Tuesday's meeting of the San Angelo City Council to hear what progress officials have made in figuring out how contaminants spilled into the Paul Ann area. While there are no restrictions on water usage as of March 2nd for most of San Angelo, industrial areas north of the Paul Ann neighborhood still cannot drink, cook, or consume city water. After a closed executive session, Water Utilities Director Allison Strube addressed the public and stated the source of the contamination is still unknown as of Tuesday. She announced more inspectors have arrived in San Angelo to assist with investigations. "We are turning over every stone," Strube said, and noted the contamination did not occur in a lake or river, but from a water customer somewhere in the industrial area. Strube said officials sealed off water from industrialized areas and said water could not circulate back into residential homes in the Paul Ann neighborhood. When officials can determine the source of San Angelo's contaminated water, Holden said she hopes the city holds those who may have been responsible accountable. "I would like to see the city put something in the works to ensure that this never happens again," Holden said. "And if the children or adults in this area that were affected need any medical attention, then that needs to be on the responsible parties." For more information on the current water situation in Paul Ann, visit the City of San Angelo's Facebook page or website. The Water Quality Lab can be reached at 325-481-2722. World War II Soldier Honored in San Angelo by Colin Murphy, published March 2nd. In the U.S. military, there is a tradition of leaving coins on the grave markers of veterans. A nickel means the visiting soldier and the deceased veteran trained together at boot camp. Leaving a dime means the soldiers served together in some capacity. A quarter means the visiting soldier was with the deceased at the time of death. A penny simply means a member of the military visited the deceased and paid respect. By the end of a ceremony at Fairmont Cemetery on Sunday, the marker honoring First Lieutenant Mark Mathis was covered with pennies and placed by dozens of members of armed forces in attendance. There were no nickels, dimes, or quarters because none of the military personnel in attendance had even been born when Mathis lost his life in the line of duty. Mathis enlisted in the U.S. Army Air Corps on April 30, 1941, at the age of 23. He served as an engine mechanic at Goodfellow Air Force Base before being deployed as a bombardier to Africa and then the European theater during World War II. After completing a bombing run over German submarine yards in 1943, Mathis's aircraft was attacked by enemy fighters over the Atlantic Ocean's North Sea. It was last seen going down over the water. The crew members were never seen alive again. Mathis's body was never recovered. On Sunday, at Fairmont Cemetery in San Angelo, a memorial plaque at the Mathis family plot was dedicated to Mark. Larry Miller, program coordinator with the Freedom Through Vigilance Association, FTVA, Heritage Chapter, said the effort to recognize Mathis was a way to remind people of what members of the armed services give up to serve their country. "We honor those who have served and perished in conflict," Miller said. we shouldn't forget these people who went off to war. In the case of Mark, his remains were never returned. These people hugged their mama, they shook their dad's hand, they kissed their loved ones, and then they went off to war and never came back. I think that's reason enough to honor their service and sacrifice. Police state child 13 reports sexual assaults from 2018. San Angelo man indicted. By Elena Edgen, published March 2nd. A San Angelo man has been indicted after a child made an outcry of sexual abuse from 2018, according to an indictment released Monday. On November 22, 2020, two women heard a 13-year-old child crying hysterically. The child was lying on their bedroom floor, according to court documents. Once the child calmed down, they told the women about a sexual assault from 2018. The women told police. During an interview with the child, they said the assault happened when they were 11 to 12 years old in San Angelo. The child stated a man coerced them and sexually assaulted them. An indictment stated the assault happened in June 2018 and an indecency by sexual contact charge occurred in May 2018. David Wayne Bradshaw, 47, was arrested December 10th on suspicion of aggravated sexual assault of a child. He remained in Tom Green County Detention Center in lieu of an $80,000 bond as of noon Tuesday, according to online jail records. The indictments charge him with aggravated sexual assault of a child and indecency with the child by sexual contact. The assault is a first-degree felony, punishable by 5 to 99 years in jail, and a fine not to exceed $10,000. The indecency charge is a second-degree felony, punishable by up to 20 years in jail. Police say woman charged with abandoning child with man who shook baby caused head injury. By Elena Edgen, published March 1st. Weeks after a man was charged with shaking a child and causing internal bleeding, a San Angelo woman was arrested in connection to the injury, according to an arrest affidavit released Friday. On February 2, 2021, police received an intake report from Child Protective Services concerning a nearly five-month-old child. The report stated a man had dropped a child who sustained a subdural hematoma. The internal bleeding injury required immediate, specialized pediatric medical treatment at Cook Center's Medical Center, records state. Investigators spoke with the man, who said he picked up the child under their arms and shook for 2 to 3 seconds. The baby became dizzy and stopped moving as much, and their crying slowed, according to the arrest affidavit. The family did not have prior history with CPS, though this was not the first time the man had shaken the baby. He told investigators about another time on October 31st, 2020, where he was going nuts, picked up the baby under their arms, and screamed at them to stop crying. A woman in the residence noticed this and ran to him in October, yelling at him to stop. At this time, the man said he was having anger problems toward his kids and did not feel attached to the baby like the other child, according to an affidavit. She told investigators the man had been suicidal since September and received medical treatment. Around October, he began doubling a controlled substance prescription without speaking to a medical professional, records state. On January 29, 2021, the woman noticed the man showed signs of withdrawals, including being in a bad mood. She told investigators she knew it was not a good idea to mix medications, but allowed him to use her controlled substance prescription. On February 2nd, she left the residence, which she shared with the man and children while she went to work. The affidavit states she knew the dangers associated with the man's mental health, controlled substance prescription abuse, and anger issues toward the infant. Shaylin Claire Brannon, 24, was arrested Thursday on suspicion of abandoning a child imminent danger of serious bodily injury. She was released from Tom Green County Detention Center on a $30,000 bond hours later. Fort Concho Looks to Revitalize Exhibits and Displays by Bob Luthart, City of San Angelo, published March 1st. Thanks to a grant from Humanities Texas, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities, and with additional support from the Fort Concho Foundation, we have completed a major study on the exhibits and their interpretation at the fort, as well as a short and long-range plan for their changes and improvement. Directed by the fort's curator of history, Corey Robinson, this extensive evaluation of our current exhibits and future needs engaged Dr. John Langlier of Tucson, Arizona, a noted researcher and author of dozens of publications on the frontier military. The COVID-19 pandemic both delayed and altered the original plan of on-site interviews, but many of our staff, board, and volunteers were still able to participate. Dr. Langlier also visited our site last fall, spending an intensive week evaluating our exhibits and collections. His detailed report will guide our board and staff as we improve and expand our exhibits while finding new ways to tell our stories. The fort currently has an impressive array of period rooms and exhibits in 10 buildings that are open to all guests 7 days a week. We cover the life of the officer and family in Officers' Quarters 3, while we tell the story of post-education and religion in the chapel and medical care in the post-hospital. The headquarters building tells visitors about the Army's administrative and professional duties, while the soldier's life is recreated in Barracks and Mess Hall 5. The Living History Stables has a blend of animal heritage with mules and wagons, plus a special room dedicated to Buffalo soldiers and living history. We have artillery and more wagons and barracks too, and special displays and changing exhibits in our visitor center at Barracks 1. Officers' Quarters 4 houses the Verizon Danner Museum of Telephony, a major collection of telephones and communication equipment given to the fort 30 years ago. So what are the recommendations? First, we need to transition from any original artifacts in these buildings to high-quality reproductions. We started this process slowly about 10 years ago and will accelerate it in the future. In most cases, you do not need the original item on display to tell a good story. We want to preserve these treasures for generations to come, which is a challenge as many display buildings lack modern climate control. Second, we should evaluate all our period rooms and explore opportunities for new display items, new themes, and expanded or different stories. The Headquarters Hospital, Chapel, Officers' Quarters 3, and Barracks Mess 5 all came online in a decade of wonderful progress in the late 1980s and early 1990s by staff under former Fort Concho director John Vaughn. Several of these displays won awards from the Texas Historical Commission, and while they remain engaging, it is time to reassess them, given the research and new information now available to us. Third, we can add new displays and stories to the Telephone Museum at Officers' Quarters 4. Communication in the fort's active era, 1867 to 89, used a fascinating blend of telegraphy, heliograms, and signal flags. We also can display some of our newest acquisitions to the Phone Museum. This same process will examine our living history stables, where we can better tell the stories of Army transportation and supply, dependent on horse and mule power. Fourth, we must address some of the themes and stories our displays do not sufficiently cover. Our past Native American displays have not done justice to the centuries of that heritage that predates the military's arrival in 1867. We can better cover the region's civilian history, especially the rich traditions of our Hispanic culture. The Buffalo Soldiers, always a central theme at a post that was 50% African American over its historic era, will remain a priority, and we should ensure that the stories of women, children, and civilian roles are told. Any fort involves more than just the soldiers themselves. Lastly, as we embark on this project that will keep us busy for the next 5 to 10 years, We need to integrate technology into our displays in an informative manner that does not overwhelm the guest or distract from the historic setting. Much of this new technology will find a home in the planned new visitor center at Barracks 1 and 2. And we must evaluate and change our many exhibit labels and interpretive banners across the site to create a clear, consistent, and effective style and appearance. We are excited for the many opportunities that await us. In the past few years, we have paid much attention to the outsides of our buildings, and within another year, the fort will look its best ever. It is time for us to look at the insides and create quality, engaging displays and experiences for our guests. Bob Bluthart is the Fort Concho site manager for the City of San Angelo. Contact him at 325-481-2730 or email robert.bluthart@sanangelotexas.us. Fatal shooting of San Angelo man after alleged drug deal leads to multiple arrests, by John Tufts and Rosanna Frere, published February 26th. Two San Angelo men and one woman have been charged in connection to the shooting death of a person found lying face down in the kitchen of an apartment building in the Riverside area. Investigators say the shooting happened Thursday night during a drug deal, according to an arrest affidavit. On Thursday, February 25th, police arrived at an apartment complex in the 3300 block of North Bryant Boulevard, where they found the body of Ray Robles, who died from trauma believed to be the result of being shot with a firearm, according to an arrest affidavit. Justice of the Peace Susan Werner declared Robles deceased and ordered an autopsy. Police say verbal altercation during drug deal led to fatal shooting. People who were in the apartment during the shooting told police Robles arrived at the apartment to buy marijuana and while there asked the marijuana to be weighed before purchasing it, according to arrest affidavits. Police were told as the marijuana was weighed, a verbal altercation took place between Robles and two others, Sierra Camarillo and Marcio Narco Portillo, whom investigators learned were selling marijuana to Robles, the affidavit stated. During the verbal altercation, investigators were told Robles pulled out a handgun he used to strike Nathaniel Gonzalez, 20, in the head, then pointed the gun at the occupants of the apartment, according to the affidavit. Witnesses told police Portillo, 21, then shot Robles in the neck. Camarillo told police after Portillo fired the first round into Robles, she watched Portillo stand over Robles while he was laying on the ground, and then Portillo shot him again, according to an affidavit. Camarillo said Portillo next dropped his gun, then took the victim's gun and fled the residence through a window, an affidavit stated. Police arrested Camarillo, 21, on charges of tampering, fabricating physical evidence with intent to impair an investigation after claiming in her initial testimony that she had shot Robles herself with his own gun multiple times in defense of Gonzalez, an affidavit stated. As of Friday, Camarillo was in Tom Green County Jail with a $100,000 bond, online jail records state. Camarillo later told police she dropped Portillo's weapon near the victim while he took the victim's weapon and fled the scene. She said she then took possession of the handgun used to shoot Robles and moved it, according to an affidavit. Portillo was taken into custody Thursday night and booked into Tom Green County Jail, where he is currently being held without bond, according to a Friday news release from the San Angelo Police Department. Police also arrested Nathan Gonzalez, 20, on charges of felony manufacture, delivery, controlled substance penalty, Group 2 or 2A, a news release stated. As of 2 p.m. Friday, Gonzalez was in Tom Green County Jail with a $75,000 bond. A spokesperson for the police department said the investigation was ongoing Friday and no other information was available for release. And as I have refreshed the website for the San Angelo Standard Times, gosanangelo.com, I see that they have posted another news story for today. Shannon Medical Center expanding downtown campus. $36 million project includes new cancer center. By John Tufts, published March 4th. Shannon Medical Center announced Thursday it plans to update its facilities by expanding its downtown campus and creating a new two-story cancer center, according to a news release. The project is expected to total $36 million, which will be funded by the Shannon Trust and will be completed over the next 18 months, according to a news release. As Shannon continues to grow, our goal is to maintain first-rate facilities, technology, and providers for our patients, stated Lynn Mertz, managing trustee of Shannon West Texas Memorial Hospital. This expansion has been a long-time goal of the trustees, but due to the COVID pandemic, everyone has been a bit distracted. Mertz said the project will focus on creating additional access and convenience for Shannon's patients, as well as consolidate services into comprehensive centers. What does the project include, and when will it start? Shannon officials said the expansion project will include four components: a new building for Shannon Outpatient Pharmacy, a new building for the Shannon Cancer Center, an office building for support services, and a parking garage structure. The new facilities will be located within the city block between Beauregard and Tuig Streets and between Oaks and Magdalen. Construction will begin in August, with completion expected in September 2022, a release stated. Shannon Pharmacy to get upgrade. Shannon Pharmacy, which is currently within the block at 119 East Beauregard, will get a new building with approximately 6,000 square feet, a news release stated. The building will have new services, including durable medical equipment, a mixing room for IV and compound medications, and an automated packager for medications, according to a news release. The new entrance will be on Oak Street and feature improved parking and two drive-through lanes. The pharmacy is planned to be complete by June 2022, a news release stated. Shannon Cancer Center to consolidate cancer services into one building. The largest part of the project will be a two-story building with approximately 51,000 square feet to house the new Shannon Cancer Center, the news release stated. Shannon Oncology Center and Shannon Radiation Therapy Services, formerly Regional Cancer Treatment Center, are currently housed within Shannon Clinic on Magdalen Street. Officials said the new facility will consolidate all outpatient oncology care and treatment services into one location as a comprehensive center of excellence to enhance multidisciplinary services for patients. Shane Plymel, president and CEO at Shannon, stated the new building will make treatment more convenient for cancer patients. In addition to providing more convenience for patients by housing all of the necessary services for cancer care together in one place, the new center will further integrate the providers and staff who know and understand the patient throughout the process, Plymel said in the news release. Our team has worked together to design this new center of excellence to provide patients with the best care, with seamless service focused on helping them and their family through this journey, he stated. Radiation oncology will be on the first floor and include exam rooms and treatment space, with two linear accelerator machines for radiation therapy. It will also feature a dedicated CT for radiation therapy treatment planning and capacity for expanded treatment modalities, including high dose rate, HDR, brachytherapy, a news release stated. The first floor will also include exam and treatment space for medical oncology. It will feature 28 chemotherapy and infusion chairs, doubling treatment capacity to serve more patients each day. It will also include a dedicated pharmacy and lab for these patients, a news release stated. The second floor will serve as space for patient education and support resources, like patient navigation and nutrition and genetic counseling, according to a news release. Offices for visiting oncology specialists with enhanced technology will be able to deliver virtual and telehealth services to provide personalized oncology care. The Cancer Center will also feature an outdoor garden space for patients to enjoy during treatment. Cancer cases continue to grow from Tom Green County and the surrounding region, Plymouth stated. We want patients to be able to receive the best care at home with their support system of family and friends. This new facility will allow us to recruit up to two more medical oncologists and another radiation oncologist as needed in the future, so care remains timely and efficient. Two-story building plan for Shannon Support Services. Support services, including Shannon's Human Resources Department, will be housed in a second two-story building, approximately 15,000 square feet, in Phase 2 Street, the news release stated. The building is projected to be complete in August 2022. To accommodate patients and staff for the new downtown buildings, the project also includes a five-story parking structure. It will include approximately 300 spaces and provide direct entrances to second floors of the Shannon Cancer Center and the office building. It should be complete by April 2022, according to the news release. The overall project was designed by O'Connell Robertson Architecture Firm of Austin. Lott Brothers Construction is the general contractor for the project. SKG Engineering of San Angelo is providing civil and structural design for the project. Most hospitals cannot do projects like this in our current healthcare economy, stated Plymouth in the news release. We are fortunate to have the local support of the Shannon Trust with their focus on providing the best facilities for our patients so we can ensure we have the capacity to serve our community as it continues to grow in the future. Vinyl Records Store opens in San Angelo. Also features local artwork. Published February 26th. A vinyl records store has opened in San Angelo that also features local artwork. Sunny Records and More opened on January 23rd at 1504 West Beauregard Avenue by Sonny Gamel. He runs the operation on his own, selling new and used vinyl records, t-shirts, posters, stickers, buttons, and artwork from local artists. Sunny Records and More is open from noon to 8 p.m. Tuesday through Saturday and noon to 5 p.m. on Sunday. For information, call 325-213-4684 or email sunnyrecords, S-O-N-N-Y, records 2020 at gmail.com. Gamel answered questions about his business. What was the inspiration for your business name? Sunny is a family name going back four generations. Who was your biggest supporter when you started? Rocio and Veronica, the owners of Denata. As established small business owners, they have experienced the usual hurdles of opening a business and have helped me avoid mistakes I definitely would have experienced without strong mentorship. What are some unexpected benefits of owning a small business? The support. The music and art community here is super rich. I wouldn't have dreamed of the positive reaction I have received from vinyl enthusiasts, local bands, and artists, as well as other business owners. The unexpected benefit is there will be always someone with advice or a helping hand. I pick San Angelo as a business location because I truly feel San Angelo is a strong place for music and art, and I believe it is undeniable. I want to be part of that, even if it is through the promotion of music. Entrepreneurship can be a lonely place. What can help with that? Honestly, I can say I have experienced less loneliness with starting a business. I've connected and made more friends through the love of vinyl and music than ever before. Every customer, young or older, has specific and unique knowledge of their own music taste. It's not uncommon for a simple transaction to turn into a long conversation. Fire ants are a tiny but significant pest in Texas, by Michael Price, special to the San Angelo Standard-Times. Anyone who has spent any amount of time outdoors in this great state of ours has undoubtedly seen them, those little dirt mounds that litter roadsides, parks, and yes, even yards. And if one is unlucky enough to step into one of these little mounds of dirt, they will soon not forget the experience. These mounds of dirt, of course, are constructed by a group of ants known as fire ants. However, what most folks are not aware of is that not all of these pesky little pistils are invasive to Texas. In fact, of the four species of this genus that currently occur in Texas, only one, the red imported fire ant, does not occur naturally here. The three indigenous species of fire ants include the southern fire ant, the desert fire ant, and the tropical fire ant. Those four species are almost visually identical to each other, only being distinguishable under a microscope where the structure of the head and mandibles are detectable. The red imported fire ant is originally native to South America, but was first discovered in Texas in the 1950s and is now likely a permanent fixture in the state's fauna. Its arrival into the United States has been traced to the port of Mobile, Alabama in the 1930s, when soil was brought from South America to be utilized for ships' ballasts. Once that first population established itself, this species began to spread eastward, northward, and westward. Drier and colder climates appear to be limiting factors to further expansion. This particular species of ant are insects, and like others of this group, they have six legs and three body parts, the head, the thorax, and the abdomen. Each one of these body parts has a specific purpose, with the head being the area where the eyes, antenna, and feeding appendages are. The thorax is where the legs and wings are attached, and the abdomen is where the majority of the internal organs are housed. Also, like others in the insect group, the skeletal structure is on the outside of their body. This structure is known as the exoskeleton. Like other ant species, this variety lives in large colonies. These colonies are most often contained in various sizes of mounds of dirt out in the open, although some colonies thrive under debris or inside of man-made structures such as electrical boxes. Colonies consist of sterile females, known as worker ants, a reproductive female, known as queen ants, and winged males. Some larger colonies may contain two or more queens and upwards of 200,000 ants in various growth stages. Adult worker ants are wingless, reddish-brown, and between 1/16 and 3/16 in total body length. Adult reproductive females are also reddish-brown, but they are a bit larger, attaining a length of 3/8 of an inch. Additionally, reproductive females have wings until they mate, when they then shed their wings. Males are winged and black in coloration. Each queen may lay up to 800 eggs daily. Upon hatching, the larvae develop through four stages of instar until they pupate. This process may take up to 1 month in colder temperatures, while in warmer climates, it may take only 3 weeks. Only the last larval stage and adults can consume solid foods. The fire ant is primarily an omnivorous species, feeding primarily on other insects and invertebrates. Although they will not refuse a meal of uneaten food items that people put out in their trash receptacles, small vertebrate animals are also consumed, as are fruit, grains, and seeds. Worker ants are highly territorial and react aggressively towards any disturbances to the mound. Biting at first to maintain their grip, these worker ants will then sting repeatedly, injecting any would-be threat with a unique toxin that produces a burning sensation, hence the common name fire ants. Most folks can tolerate multiple bites with no significant medical issues, only developing small, white-filled pustules at the sting site a day or two after the encounter. However, as with any sting from a venomous creature, secondary infection is always a concern, so one should consult a physician after any happenstances where stings occur. Due to sheer numbers, this animal is considered to be a serious pest, not only to crops and gardens, but to local wildlife populations as well. There are many ways to control this species by natural, non-chemical means. A simple Google search can reveal these protocols. Michael Price is owner of Wild About Texas, an educational company that specializes in venomous animal safety training, environmental consultations, and ectotourism. Contact him at wildabouttexas@gmail.com. And now here's our column from Allison Watkins. Lawn care may require a different approach this year after extreme freeze. Published February 26th. Right now is normally the time of year we recommend applying pre-emergent to lawns to prevent winter weeds. But after the winter storm, it's a little more complicated. Pre-emergent herbicides are products that help prevent annual weeds from popping up from seed. There are a number of different products that can be used on a healthy, well-established lawn that won't hurt the turf grass or other well-established plants if applied correctly. But the key point is that they are designed to be applied on healthy turf. The products labeled for home lawns are root inhibitors and can slow down recovery if the turf is stressed. So lawns may be damaged from the extreme freeze, especially St. Augustine lawns. So wait and see if the lawn is stressed or damaged from winter kill before applying pre-emergent. If the lawn is stressed, focus on other methods of weed control, such as mechanical, hand pulling, and hoeing may be the best bet. Also, the timing is a bit delayed because of the cold snap. The recommendation from Texas A&M turf specialists is to apply pre-emergent when the soil temperature reaches 55 degrees Fahrenheit for several days. We hit that mark right before the winter storm, but now the soil temperature 5-day average has dropped back down. The current soil temperature and the 5-day average can be viewed at the website www.greencastonline.com/tools/soil-temperature. High-value, intensely managed turf grass can be assessed for winter kill by digging up plugs and planting them in containers in a warm, sunny spot. Water and care for them and see what percentage of the plugs survived and how vigorously they grew. Most homeowners will probably prefer to just wait and see how spring green-up goes. Just water appropriately when it warms up, keep an eye on the turf, and don't fertilize too early. Wait until the lawn has needed to be mowed twice before fertilizing. Keep an eye out for pests, and just give the turf grass some good TLC through the spring to help it bounce back if damaged. As much as we want to find as many silver linings as possible to the problematic deep freeze, the cold spell will likely not have a huge impact on insect pests. For example, fire ants burrow deep into the ground and most likely avoided the deadly temperatures. To learn more about spring landscaping in West Texas and recovery from winter damage, save the date for a seminar on trees, lawns, and edible landscape crops, Thursday, March 18th. Visit the website tomgreen.agrilife.org for details and how to register. Allison Watkins is the Texas A&M AgriLife Extension Agent for Horticulture in Tom Green County. Contact her at aewatkins@ag.tamu.edu.
Thank you for joining us for this reading of the San Angelo Standard Times. This is the Recording Library of West Texas, enriching the lives of individuals with physical, visual, and learning disabilities since 1963. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.